You looked at small-town Indiana and how Latinos tried to construct community and win acceptance from predecessors in the community. It's not all banners and demonstrations. In fact, very little is. What is daily life like for immigrants trying to establish their home places?
Well, I think that's one of the things that got me started in wanting to do this work, is that I found that folks were purchasing homes. They were obviously working in the community alongside other members of the community. They were making friends. They were going to church. Their children were going to school. Many of them purposely moved to, you know, what would be considered downstate Indiana, like downstate Illinois, to get out of the urban centers and provide a safer place for their families to grow. So I found a lot of parallels with the local non-Latino, white and black communities of that area. So their daily life was much like the daily life of everyone else living in that town.
How did they try to get white Hoosier space to accept them?
Easier said than done, obviously. One of the things I document in the book is they would have public events, public performances, religious holidays in public, not really as an attempt to force Hoosiers to accept them, but really to say that we are part of being a Hoosier as well. And this is our land to also participate in. And so they would have these events publicly to say, you know, we're here to stay, and this is our Hoosier land as well, and we want to participate by having a public space.
Was that uncomfortable or accepted?
You know, it was interesting. So they'd done these religious holidays, for instance, like the Stations of the Cross, the Via Crucis, or the Virgin Guadalupe processions. They've been doing them for years. But this particular year, when the book was written, was a particular heightened political moment of a lot of intense political rhetoric against the immigrant population.
2006.
It was in 2006, exactly, so 11 years ago. And that was, for those of us that remember, when Representative Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin introduced a bill at the national level to criminalize undocumented immigrants. So I wasn't sure what to expect. They were out in public and doing the rituals they've been doing for every year. And I was actually pleasantly surprised by the amount of white Hoosiers that joined them, that marched with them, that prayed with them, that collectively came together and said, we're not going to let this national political moment infringe on the way that we react with each other. So in that case, it was nice. I was on the procession with them, and there was other situations where drivers were rude. There was some children along the procession, the religious procession, and a few almost got run over by individuals that were just impatient and not happy. But by and large, for those moments, there was a coming together of sorts.
The people who joined them, are those their natural allies? Who were those people, and how did they contrast to those who were doing ethnic slurs and workplace intimidation and things like that?
So because predominantly what I researched was white Catholics, I also did some research and interviews with, Latino Catholics, but Latino Baptists, Latino Mormons as well. But what I saw with the processions, it was other white Catholics who said, you know, we have more in common than separates us. And so these were natural allies because they celebrated the same faith. And they came out and said, you know, we're one in our faith. We are one as a people. And this was in contrast to letters to the editor, really mean, horrific comments, political flyers that were sent that created this image that this community was criminal, was violent, was a danger to the locality. And the folks that went to church with Latinos, worked with Latinos, were neighbors with Latinos, knew better. And some individuals came out in support with them.
How did they react to the horrible things that were going on? What was the impact on them?
On Latinos?
Mm-hmm.
The first few letters to the editor were, again, pretty harsh, mean, spirited. And I remember a few attempts where people wrote back. And so the educated community members, the folks that had a formal education, tried to create a few letters that were attempting to counter the discourse, to counter the rhetoric. But they quickly found out that they were going to, for every positive letter written in, there was at least 7 to 10 negative ones in response to that positive one. So instead of focusing on letters to the editor, they thought, okay, let's get a fiesta together. Let's get a community event together where we showcase who we are, our culture, our identity, our neighborhood's collectivity, instead of the criminality that's being broadcasted nationally. So they did events. They did a party, a fiesta, where they held, they had food, they had dancing, they had music, to showcase that positive part of their contributions.
Did things ease?
I think so. I mean, obviously, it's slow going. You had more people come together. And the important, so that happened, the first one was in 2007. And it's been going on ever since. And so that was, it was a coming together of folks in 2006 to plan it for 2007. And it's 2017, and they just had one, I believe. So
that was a moment of high tension nationally. We're in another moment of high tension. Does the previous instance provide any guide for dealing with the present atmosphere?
One of the things I talk about towards the end of the book is, and in fact in the conclusion chapter, is what this means for other communities, right? That obviously this was Central Indiana. It's a particular case. But it's not that particular. You have communities across the nation that are going through the same distraught interactions that are fueled sometimes by politics. And one of the things I mentioned there is what needs to be done is people coming together, talking to each other, seeing each other as humans, and not the rhetoric that unfortunately they're being fueled, that politicians are fueling.
One of the places, though, where that happens the most is also a place that tends to have ethnic tensions, mm-hmm. the workplace. Mm-hmm. There's workplace segregation that you
yes.
note in third shift
yes.
For Latinos, or
yes.
the boiler room
yes.
Being relegated to the kitchen. How does that change over time, and how can that be accomplished?
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, Latino workers, especially immigrant Latino workers, are afraid to speak up because they're afraid of what that means for their job security. And so you won't often find them saying, you know, can I get the second shift, or I'd really rather not work in the boiler room. But often it takes the case of someone else saying, you know, Jose's done an amazing job. Let's move into a different shift. So they need allies. They need coalitions of folks that are going to speak up for them and with them to create a better environment for them in the workplace. Because I honestly think that a lot of workers have obviously more in common than that separates them. They work in the same environment. They get paid almost similar.
Do they?
Well, sometimes not. But, you know, they're working class, right? They're men and women that are working class folks. And I believe they have more in common in terms of their struggles than politicians or the media would have us believe.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Suhi Vega, an anthropologist at Arizona State University, who's in Bloomington Normal to talk about her book, Latino Heartland, as part of the Community Reads Partnership between ISU's Latin American and Latino Studies Program and the McLean County Museum of History. There is an expectation by white Hoosierdom of assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
And the comparison is often made, in not just in Indiana, but in central Illinois as well, to the German experience
right.
of assimilation, mm-hmm. where you give up the language, you keep some of the cute ethnic customs, but not the core identity. How do Latinos react to that expectation and that stereotype?
I think there's two things to be said about that. One is, historically speaking, right, Germans in particular weren't ones to immediately give up their heritage, their customs, their identity.
It's false, then.
Yeah,
it's a false narrative,
exactly. So that what my book talks about is in this particular German community, folks fought tooth and nail, sometimes against religious figures that were their superiors, to maintain language, to maintain culture and identity. And unfortunately, right, we're up on the anniversary of World War I, and its impact on the German population. And for me, that's a cause of reflection, because if we think about what those families went through, that's a lot of pain. That's a lot of suffering. That's a lot of shame that these communities had to go through. And I think present-day Latinos don't want that for their children. Right.
Well, what the Germans went through was language law exclusion. Exactly. It was economic discrimination. Mm-hmm. It was cross burnings in front of their yard by the Klan. It was slaughtering of dachshunds as an image of the German Kaiser. Right. It was all of this this horrible stuff. Right. And how are we that close to what's happening now?
I feel we are, actually. I live in Arizona, but that's not a particular case. I think that we probably have cases of them here in Illinois and Indiana. And I don't think it has to be as obvious as a cross-burning. I talk about in the book that there's felt rejections, or rechazo, as we say in Spanish, which is just those snubs, microaggressions, those moments where you just don't feel like people welcome you in a space. And no, there aren't crosses being burnt in your front yard, but you don't feel welcomed. And I think that's obviously still going on with this population. And one thing I wish would happen more is that reflection piece, the reflection of our ancestors, if you're German, or even if you're not German, right, what they must have gone through, and not wanting to perpetuate that same animosity towards the present day.
Give us a couple examples of that, would you? Microaggressions and small, unthinking betrayals of your own, of a mindset that is exclusionary.
So, for instance, one happened, I talk a lot about Walmart in my book, because Walmart came up again and again as a space of interaction, a space where people, and this goes back to their all working class communities, they interact because this is the place where they shop, because this is the place where they can afford their goods. And so often Walmart becomes a space where people sometimes see each other, and sometimes that creates tension. And in one case, there was a mom, young mom. She was Mormon, Latina mom, and she had, I want to say, three small kids. And she was teaching her kids how to speak Spanish because she wanted to make sure that they learned both languages. And so she asked them in Spanish to go grab something from the aisle. And two women were in the aisle, two white women, older white women were in the aisle. And one says to the other, "These Mexicans with their kids," in a very disparaging tone. And the mom, who happens to be Mexican-American and knew English, obviously, being raised here, turns to the women and says, "Yes, aren't my children a blessing?" Right? And in that moment, she counteracts the negativity, right, that these women were doing. They were chastising this woman as being over-fertile, for having too many kids, for being irresponsible, et cetera, all the stereotypes we have. And this mom really was offended, but instead of turning it, right, in a negative way, she turned it back on them and said, "You know, my children are a blessing, and I appreciate them." And she did so in English to assert that she knows English as well. So that's a sort of microaggression, because these women had no idea this other woman spoke English, and so they felt that it was safe to be negative in that way.
Well, let's look at the use of language. I mean, non-Latinos often view use of Spanish as self-segregation. How can that barrier be surmounted?
Well, I think one thing we have to think is past, and I'll talk about this a little bit, that we have to think past the notion of being bilingual as a negative. Unfortunately, we in our country want to say that you have to speak English, you have to speak it today, as in yesterday, and you have to learn it quickly. It's not an easy process, and those of us that learn a different language know it's a difficult thing to learn two languages. But for many families, the reason they speak Spanish is because they want to maintain it. It's a skill to be bilingual. Obviously, in this global world, it's a skill to have two languages, and they know that their children are learning English in school. That's an obvious, but they want to make sure their children don't forget the Spanish, because those two things together make for a much richer experience. And economically speaking, it makes for a better workforce as well, to have more than one language. So I think that we have to rethink the way that we see bilingual or other languages spoken in our environment. It's not negative. It's actually a positive to have these languages being spoken about.
Is there optimism in the difference between first and second generation immigrant experiences?
So it's interesting. It depends on the area and the region. Sometimes first generation, that is the immigrant experience, struggles with the language, struggles with the new environment, struggles with the workplace. And their children navigate this world a different way, right? They are sometimes born here. They are definitely raised here. They know the culture. They know the language. And that would seem to be a great thing because they can navigate both worlds. But sometimes those children get caught up in not knowing which one to be. And it's made even that much worse by a society that forces them to assimilate. And so there's a crisis moment for some second-generation Latinos who, on the one hand, are very proud of their family and what they're coming from. On the other hand, you have a society telling them they have to assimilate. And so it's a difficult process for some. And what I found that in this case, the second generation was actually really helpful in defending the first generation, in asserting a right to belong, in defending their parents against some of the vile discussions happening by politicians locally as well as nationally.
Professor Suje Vega is the author of Latino Heartland of Borders and Belonging in the Midwest. That's the Community Reads book being discussed Saturday at the McLean County Museum of History in downtown Bloomington at 1 p.m. Thanks so much for joining us.